This is a CBC podcast.
CBC podcasts are supported by HP Print Studio. Express your brand with HP Print Studio. Find free, customized templates to build your business identity, like letterhead, business cards, and shipping labels. Start the journey at www.hp.ca/print.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi. This is Q, the podcast. Okay, on your program today, live from London, author Sebastian Fox is both shaken and stirred. The acclaimed British novelist took on the job of writing the latest James Bond novel, and now it's a worldwide bestseller. Sebastian Fox, first up. And Shazia Mirza, the outspoken comic and columnist, is making it on her own terms in the comedy world, not afraid to poke fun at and defend her Muslim faith. She'll join me in about 30 minutes. Plus, Helen Couchman, the British photographer, takes us behind the scenes with Olympic site construction workers in Beijing. All that and some ting ting too. This is Q. Well, our first guest today on this very first London show will need to be patient with me because he must be getting quite tired of introductions like this. His name is Fox. Sebastian Fox. He is a commander of the British Empire, a former journalist and editor with The Guardian and The Independent newspapers, and the world-renowned author behind literary bestsellers Charlotte Gray and Birdsong. His book Human Traces, published in 2005, was described by critic Sir Trevor Nunn as a masterpiece of this or any other century. Most recently, Sebastian Fox has been on a special assignment with one of England's favorite heroes. Fox channeled Ian Fleming, the famed writer of the James Bond books, to pen Devil May Care, the newest installation in the Bond book series. It joins his other works on the global bestseller list, and I'm pleased to welcome Sebastian Fox live to me in studio here in London. Hello, sir.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good to have you here. Let's get your microphone on there. Now you can say hello to me.
Hi, for the second time. Now you can hear me.
Hello, Canada. Redux. It's a pleasure to have you on this program. It's interesting to hear how this book came about. I've heard you say that you didn't actually, when you were contacted about writing a James Bond book, you had some trepidation. You weren't sure if it was for you. And as a writer of historical fiction, it doesn't necessarily follow that you'd be a James Bond writer. What changed your mind and made you want to do it?
I think when the idea was first put to me, it seemed to me ridiculous, preposterous, because the book that I published just before then was Human Traces, which you referred to just now, which is a 650-page book about psychiatry and consciousness and set in the late 19th, early 20th century and about, you know, what makes human beings different from other species in the world and so on. You know, it's a novel, it's a story, but these are the themes of it. It's a very, very serious book. And the thought that I might write a thriller, I mean, albeit a rather specialized kind of thriller, a James Bond story, seemed ridiculous when I don't really read thrillers. I don't really know much about the genre at all. But I was tempted. I was intrigued, as you would be, and partly because I was so exhausted by all the seriousness of what I'd been doing that, you know, so it was like someone saying, hey, do you want to come outside and play football for half an hour?
Well, of course, you do. Right. But you were worried that Ian Fleming, that the writing was going to just be pulp fiction. You hadn't read the Bond books, had you?
I hadn't read the Bond books since I was about 12 or 13 years old. And then I read probably three or four maybe maximum. Then, like everyone else, I went to see the movies, you know, which were already coming out by, you know, at that time. Sean Connery was then James Bond. But anyway, I went to see the Fleming family and they put this proposition to me. Would you like to do this book? It's just a one-off. It's a special centenary celebration and so on and so forth. And the deal was, I said, look, okay, I'm not sure about this, but I'll go and read Ian Fleming's own books. And if I like them and I can see a way of doing something similar that would be, you know, in the spirit of the whole thing, then I'll do it. So I went away and I read them from start to finish chronologically. And they were much better than I expected they would be. I mean, very much of their period, but the most important thing about them was simply that Fleming created this sense of danger, of jeopardy about this character. Within about 10 pages, you thought, oh dear, he's in a bad circumstance here, in a bad situation, and he's only got soft shoes on, he's only got a tiny little gun, which is really no good to anybody in his pocket. And, you know, the odds are overwhelmingly against him, and you kind of worried for
him. And he wasn't a superhero.
No.
In those early books.
No, he was a guy, you know, very much more like you or me. I mean, okay, he had a gun, but it was a small one, not a powerful thing. But apart from that, he was someone who relied on his wits, really. He was driven by, you know, patriotism, a devotion to his boss, this strange, grumpy ex-naval officer, and to the service, which is a mysterious organization, which is kind of part Secret Service spying thing, but also part global policeman. But it's essentially a very sort of patriotic thing that he's involved in. And the character of Bond developed a lot over the years through the movies until by the end of the sort of the 20th century, the Pierce Brosnan films, you have what you just said, a sort of superhero kind of guy. Yeah. He's more akin really to Batman or Spider-Man or Superman, really. But that's not how he began. And in fact, it's not how he's carrying on. I think they, you know, the filmmakers have very cleverly reinvented him with
Daniel Craig. Yeah. But you made an interesting decision. So you read these books and you feel comfortable with it. And you know, okay, I'm going to... And then you decide that you're not going to write this book like... as Sebastian Fox, the best-selling, renowned British author, but you're going to write the book in the style of Ian Fleming. Why did you make that decision?
Well, I couldn't write it in my own style because they weren't my people. They weren't my characters. You know, I didn't invent Bond and Miss Moneypenny and M and so on. And, you know, I write about what people are thinking and feeling and so on. And we don't know what Bond feels, if he feels anything. We don't really know what he thinks about things. So if I'd written it in, as I tend to write books, though, of course, I have a different style depending on the book. You know, for instance, Englebee, my most recent book, is written in a very conversational first-person style.
Right.
Human Traces is written in a very old-fashioned sour style with long sentences. But none of this would have been appropriate to Bond. It wouldn't have worked. And indeed, there were times in the story when I wanted to slow it down a little bit to give the reader time to sort of, you know, collect their thoughts. And so at that point, I would try to show Bond kind of collecting his thoughts and taking stock of the situation. And it was very difficult because, you know, Bond doesn't really have this kind of inner life that is the stock in trade of novelists like me. So it only made sense to write it in the style of Fleming, which is in any case... a fairly straightforward. It's a good style for the job.
It's quite bold, though. It's quite bold to on the cover of the book, Sebastian Fox writing as Ian Fleming, even for someone as prolific and successful as you, to say I'm going to step into Ian Fleming's shoes. Were you concerned about that? I mean, you have played at writing in someone else's voice before in your short book Pistache. I'm thinking the book features essays written in the voices of Enid Blyton, Martin Amis, Jane Austen, William Shakespeare. But were you concerned about stepping into Ian Fleming's voice and style?
No, it was quite easy to work out how he did it. I mean, he writes as a journalist, really, and I trained as a journalist, and Ian Fleming and he learned how to write as a correspondent for Reuters news agency in Moscow. And I recognize the style. There are no adjectives. There are short sentences. There are no semicolons. Lots of verbs. It's very clear and factual. And it's a good style for getting getting a story told and getting maximum information across. The only thing that was harder for me to catch was not the style itself, but the tone of voice. And there's a kind of tone that Fleming has sometimes, which gave the books their flavour, which is a rather condescending tone in which he is saying under the lines, beneath the lines, he's saying, I am taking you, reader, into a world that's really a little bit beyond and above you. You're going to be a little bit out of your depth here. Mm. But James Bond and I, we know about this world of casinos and smart tuxedos and fancy drinks and so on. So, you know, we'll look after you here. Is a slightly snobbish, condescending tone, which, funnily enough, is not off-putting. It's kind of exciting, and it gave the books their glamour, really.
Situate, if you can, for me, James Bond in contemporary England, because and this is our first show here in London. We're going to be here for a few days. One of the things we're trying to discover is the cultural zeitgeist of London. And it seems to me that the original James Bond was something of a throwback to the proper the British Empire, to a certain extent. I mean, just in his integrity and who he was. Do you still see Britain as needing that kind of hero? Where do you think James Bond fits into today's UK?
Well, I don't think Bond was as you describe him, in fact. I think he was the first British sort of hero who was actually rather unsportsmanlike and ungentlemanly. And Ian Fleming was at considerable pains to stress his cruelty and coldness. And I think that was another thing that made him so popular at the time in the 50s and 60s, was that he was new in that sense. And he
So the eloquence and the tuxedo were a front.
Yeah, but they were a front, yes. I mean, but they were, you know, bad people wear smart clothes. That's okay. That wasn't difficult to get our heads around. The function that Bond served was to make a lot of people reading in the late 50s feel that Britain still mattered in the world, because although we'd won with the help of our Canadian and other allies, won the Second World War, you know, we'd lost an empire and we'd lost all our money. And, you know, kids like me who grew up in the 50s and 60s, you know, it was a drab, dour place. You weren't allowed to travel abroad because there was a controls on how much money you could take out. I mean, rationing was still going on in the 1950s. And here was this guy hopping on a jet, you know, going off all over the world with a little gun and eating lovely food, drinking great. The sun is always shining too in Bond. Always, always the sun is shining. And he meets these girls and they're all so willing. And this was, you know, a fantastic picture to represent to people at that time.
Although he isn't necessarily willing in your book, I've noticed. He doesn't he doesn't take it up as much as he could, the offers from these women he meets.
Well, it takes him a little time. Ian Fleming left James Bond in a pretty poor state at the end of Fleming's own series of books. So in realistic terms, I had to give him you know, a little sabbatical to sort of recover his full force. But by midway through the book, he is firing on all cylinders, I assure you.
But sorry, I cut you off. I mean, you've reset it for me. So there's a desire to recapture the British greatness. This is when you're saying when Fleming was writing these through the 50s and into the early 60s. What now?
I think Bond now has become really largely a film character, and Eon Films, who did the deal with Ian Fleming in the 50s or 60s, whenever they did the deal, have developed the character through the Fleming books and then out of them using stories of their own into this kind of superhero of the late 20th century. And they've now reinvented him as a much more down-to-earth character through Daniel Craig, but I don't think that it's easy to relate the James Bond of today to, in any kind of serious way, to British culture. I mean, he's a kind of fantasy figure, and even at the time, Ian Fleming referred to his books dismissively as sort of pillow book fantasies of a fevered schoolboy mind or something like that. So I think, you know, you can get a bit too solemn about you know, Bond and British culture. It's a story, it's an adventure.
I wonder what this has been like for you after so much success with your historical novels, Birdsong, Charlotte Gray, Human Traces. You seem to have surprised your followers with Engleby, which you mentioned, which is set in the 1970s. And then this book, Devil May Care, you're writing as Ian Fleming. Have you enjoyed a freedom of not having to be Sebastian Fox, who writes historical fiction?
Yeah, I never really think of my books as historical novels in that sense, which seems to be a kind of genre thing of, you know, people dressed up in, you know, long gowns and saying, ooh, gadzooks, my lord. You know, they're not like that.
You don't write with a fountain pen?
No, they're novels which happen to be set in various different decades. But yeah, actually, most great novels are historical. You know, if you look at the great novels of the 19th century that are sort of, you know, famous, you know, War and Peace and all these, a few of them are set at the time of writing. Most of them are set back 10, 30, 40, 50 years, and that's all I've done. But to answer your question about feeling liberated, it was fun. It was like a holiday. And, you know, I think I've sort of earned it after 25 years or whatever it is, sort of striving at these very serious books to have 6 weeks off doing something fun. But I'm back writing, you know, one of my own. And although doing the Bond book was, as I say, it was 6 weeks of intensely good fun. It made me laugh when I was writing it. It's quite funny, I think. I hope so. I'm, you know, I wouldn't do it again. It's like a sort of holiday romance, you know. I don't regret it. I'm really pleased. But, you know, now I'm home. I don't want to receive a call from anyone I met on holiday.
Interesting. Yeah. Even as successful as it's been. When you talk about the great novels being set in the past, that's a good segue into what I wanted to ask you. But I understand you've found contemporary Britain, you say, an impossible subject to write about. Why?
Well, that's a question which I've struggled hard to explain to myself as much as to anyone else. And if you could come up with a convincing answer to that, then I think you'd have a real key to understanding British society. But the fact of the matter is that the great contemporary American writers, the very famous ones we all know, Philip Roth, Updike, Bellow, and so on, they've all taken as their subject, the America outside their window, the America at the end of the road.
On the road, yeah.
And they've written very serious, deep, realistic books about that. And if you were told that the new Philip Roth, the guy is a teacher in Columbia University and so on, you think, that's interesting, and it's going to be about Jewish emigration, it's going to be about political correctness, it's going to be about the state of the union, where we are, European history, American history, and it's going to be about sex and death, and it's going to be deep and resonant. But if you hear that a contemporary British writer, his main character, is in a realistic novel, sort of teaches at London University, you think it's going to be some kind of campus comedy. And, if you say Chicago in a Saul Bellow voice, people think, ah, yes. But if you say, Leicester or Neasden, people just laugh. There is something.
Why?
I don't know. There's something about British society. It's something about English society. It's not true of Scotland, for instance. There's something about English society which is just automatically self-parodying. It's very, very weird. But the success novels about contemporary England have not been realistic novels. They've all been surreal or, magically realistic or whatever you want to call it. We don't have a Bellow or an Updike or a Roth. The creature does not exist, and it's just some weird dislocation in English society.
Having said that, I understand this new book you're talking about is a Dickensian epic that's set in 2008.
The one I'm writing now, since
having said what you've said,
yes, having said what
you,
I said,
you will now undo it.
Yes, I've tried to find a way. To me, it's the big conundrum, and it's the big white whale that this is the one that someone has to go out there and harpoon, and so I am going to try and do it now. I've written about 40,000 words, and it'll be about 200,000 words. And, when I finish this, I'll go back to my little office and write 40,000 and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But already I am finding that it's becoming slightly satirical in a way that I didn't really expect. And, if that's the only way to be, fine, because if you think of, Vanity Fair, or if you think of Bleak House or Our Mutual Friend, or these big sort of 19th century novels, Vanity Fair, the very title suggests it's highly satirical of society. And I think, satire is okay.
But what about someone like Hanif Qureshi? Would he not be capturing contemporary London and England?
Yeah, that's possible, but from a kind of an angle.
Right, an outsider, potentially.
And that's also true. That is a good point, that people whose families are, first or second generation in this country, they do bring a kind of freshness. Or Zadie Smith, actually, is another example. Though I would argue that they're not really realistic, those novels. But that is one way. But for a kind of, old-style English guy like me, and indeed of my generation, it has proved an elusive thing.
Let me ask you this as I wrap up with you. You don't look that old style to me, sitting across from the table. You look pretty young. But from what I understand, this new book, you tell me if I'm wrong, 12 characters, including a footballer, a hedge fund manager, a tube train driver. I talked in my opening of this show about London as a place of renewal and rejuvenation. How would you describe your London right now?
I think everything you said in the opening is probably true, but it doesn't necessarily ring true with a resident, because when you actually live in someone, I've lived here for 30 years, it's hard to kind of to see it from the outside, really. And so I've never really bought into any of the cliches about English stereotypes and English people being whatever we're supposed to be, reserved and polite and all that kind of stuff. So I don't really buy into all those stereotypes are dead, because, they were never really alive to me. But certainly it is noticeable coming on the subway, on the tube, as I did just now to come to the studio. You don't see many old-style white British people speaking, as I'm speaking to you, and it's quite true about the large variety of languages. But London's always been a city of vast immigration. It's always been in flux. It's always been changing, and that's what's given its vitality. But I think it's also a stupendously rich city. That's what's really changed, I think, perhaps most noticeably in
materially rich. You mean?
Yeah, materially rich over the last 10 years or so. Just amazing sums, and the British economy is driven from the city of London, the financial district. And that does have an effect on central London, on property prices and so on and so forth. And that has in turn, I think, affected the sort of balance of who lives here. So you may have sort of immigrant groups will stay for a generation, but then they tend to move out because they're squeezed out. And what were originally kind of slum areas in the East End, as every city has, then become colonized by richer people. There's a kind of endlessly sort of revolving door of economic progress. But I mean, I'm sure this isn't peculiar to London, but I do think the amazing wealth generated by the city has had a huge, by the City of London, has had a huge effect over the last 10 years.
It's a great pleasure to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
British author Sebastian Fox, he writes as Ian Fleming in his latest book, Devil May Care. It is published in Canada by Doubleday.
This is Q, the podcast, with Gian Gameshi from CBC Radio 1.
Shazia Mirza has impeccable timing. She got onto the British comedy circuit just before September 11th, 2001. After that date, her life as a Muslim woman in England became an instant source of provocative material. She shocked, delighted, and offended audiences in 2001 when she kicked off a routine in a London comedy club with this joke: "I'm Shazia Mirza. At least that's what it says on my pilot's license." To top it off, Shazia was wearing a head covering or hijab at the time. Soon after uttering that deadpan line, she became one of the hottest comedy acts in Europe, with big ambitions to conquer North America as well. Here in England, she's become a popular and award-winning weekly columnist with the New Statesman magazine, and she just performed at the Glastonbury Festival this past weekend. Recently, she's been collecting more American fans as one of the 12 finalists on the US TV show Last Comic Standing 6. Here's a bit of her routine from an early round.
I don't smoke, I don't drink, I've never drunk alcohol in my life because it's against my religion. What isn't? But I have taken ecstasy. Because it doesn't say anything in the Quran about ecstasy.